A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's follow-up arrives with something most noise complaints never have. Actual numbers. 68 decibels with the window open. 40 with it closed.
Because the number he's measuring isn't the number that's keeping him awake. The 40 decibels he's getting with the window closed is A-weighted, which is tuned to human speech frequencies. The percussion from rock excavation lives down in the 80 to 200 Hz range, and A-weighting discounts that band almost entirely. If he'd switched the meter to C-weighting, the closed window reading would probably be 15 to 20 decibels higher.
So, the meter says 40. The nervous system says jackhammer.
Structural remediation, personal measures, masking, the psychological side. And he wants an honest answer about whether owning the place and spending without limit would get him to something he could live with long term. Not a library. Just not torture.
The word he used was torture. I don't think that's hyperbole, and I don't think we should soften it. Unpredictable start. Stop percussion for years. In your bedroom. In the place you're supposed to recover. That's a specific kind of erosion.
He's right that glazing alone won't eliminate it. The airborne path through glass is one of four or five parallel paths. You close one, and the others just carry more of the load.
Let's lay those paths out, because I think the physical picture is the thing most people never get. Sound from a jackhammer outside reaches a bedroom through the window, through the wall around the window, through the frame itself, through any ventilation gaps, and through the building structure. Daniel's measurement isolates only the total.
And the wall around the window is often the weakest link people ignore. Israeli construction is concrete block with plaster, which is actually decent mass, but the window is set into an opening with a gap around the frame that gets filled with foam or mortar, and that junction is a flanking path. Sound doesn't need the window to be open. It needs any two materials with different stiffness touching each other.
Flanking. That's the word for what Daniel's hand on the glass is feeling.
Right. The percussion hits the rock, the energy travels through bedrock into the building foundation, up through columns and slabs, and the window frame is bolted into that vibrating structure. The glass becomes a diaphragm. It's not letting sound through, it's being shaken by the building.
Which is why the most expensive acoustic window on the market, a triple glazed unit with two laminated panes and a huge air gap, might buy him three more decibels over what he already has. The window was never the dominant path for this particular noise.
The glazing industry doesn't love admitting that. Acoustic windows are sold on the airborne sound reduction number, the RU value. A good acoustic window can hit RU 45 to 50. That's the lab number for diffuse airborne noise. It says almost nothing about structure-borne transmission below 200 Hz.
So when Daniel says he was heartbroken to learn a basic solution could have resolved months of jackhammering, I'd soften that. The window would have helped with honking, with traffic, with voices on the street. It wouldn't have silenced rock hammering.
Let me put some numbers on it. Rock excavation percussion is broadband, but the energy peak sits around 63 to 125 Hz. At those frequencies, a standard double-glazed window with a 12mm gap might give you 25 to 30 decibels of reduction. Daniel measured 28 with his window closed. That's consistent. The window is already performing to spec. The problem is the source is so loud that even a 30 decibel reduction leaves 40 decibels of residual. And 40 decibels of low-frequency impulsive noise is still very perceptible in a quiet room.
The quiet room is the other half. Ambient noise in his bedroom with the window closed might be 25 to 30 decibels, so the hammering is sitting 10 to 15 decibels above the noise floor. That's not a subtle signal.
And it's impulsive. The ear doesn't average impulsive noise the way a meter does. Each strike is a transient, and the auditory system treats transients as salient even at low absolute levels. That's the start-stop unpredictability Daniel described. A constant 40 decibel hum is ignorable. A hammer that stops for lunch and starts again is a threat signal every single time.
This is the part where the physics meets the psychology. and I think it's the most useful thing we can give him. The nuisance isn't just the sound pressure level. It's the combination of low frequency, impulsiveness, and lack of control.
Control is the clinical word. Noise annoyance research consistently finds that the same acoustic event is rated as far more annoying when the listener can't predict it and can't stop it. Daniel can't control the construction schedule. He can't control the source. So his auditory system stays in a low-grade alert state, and that's exhausting in a way that a steady air conditioner is not.
His point about headphones is the sharpest thing in the prompt. Passive earplugs and active noise cancellation mean permanently wearing something to get quiet in your own home. And he's right that this is rarely discussed as a cost. ANC is sold as a convenience, not as a prosthetic for a hostile acoustic environment.
ANC also has a real limitation here. Active noise cancellation works best on steady, low-frequency, predictable noise. Aircraft cabin hum, air conditioning rumble. It's poor at impulsive, broadband, transient sounds. A jackhammer strike is too fast for the feed-forward algorithm to cancel. The processor gets the reference signal, generates the inverse wave, and by the time it's in your ear, the strike has already happened. You get a few decibels of reduction at best, and some people report the residual artifact is worse than the original.
So, the one technology people reach for is the one least suited to this exact noise.
Passive earplugs are actually better for impulse. Deep-fit foam plugs with a high noise reduction rating will take 20 to 30 decibels off the peaks. But Daniel's point stands. He doesn't want to live in earplugs. And wearing them for 8 hours a day has its own consequences.
What consequences?
Ear canal irritation, wax impaction, increased risk of infection for some people. But the bigger issue is the psychological one he flagged. Some people develop hypervigilance around noise after long exposure. The auditory system lowers its threshold for threat detection. They start hearing noise they never noticed before. The refrigerator, the neighbor's door, distant traffic. And the Norwegian facade retrofit studies found the same thing from the other direction.
So the earplugs become a trap. You wear them because the construction is unbearable, and then the quiet they provide recalibrates your baseline, and ordinary noise starts to feel unbearable too.
The walls, the floor, the ventilation ducts, the pipe penetrations, every little gap and rigid connection. The sound finds them. There's a difference between hyperacusis, which is reduced tolerance to ordinary sound, and misophonia, which is an emotional response to specific trigger sounds. Chronic construction noise exposure can nudge people toward the first.
What does the best case structural intervention look like, and what does it buy?
The honest answer is that premium acoustic glazing buys him something real but not transformative. Laminated glass, which sandwiches a viscoelastic layer between panes, adds damping and improves low-frequency performance somewhat. Daniel's spectrum analyzer already showed him this, though he may not have known to read it that way.
The second tool is the hand on the glass. That's a free vibration sensor. If you can feel the percussion in the window frame, the wall, or the floor, you're dealing with structure-borne transmission, and the fix isn't glazing.
The third tool is a simple one. Walk the room and listen at different points. Corners, near the window, near the wall, the middle of the room. Low-frequency energy builds up in corners and at walls due to room modes. If the hammering is dramatically louder in one corner, that's a standing wave, and acoustic treatment can help. If it's uniform everywhere, the room is being driven by the structure.
Room modes. In a bedroom, the lowest mode might be around 40 to 60 hertz, depending on dimensions. That's right in the hammering band, so the room itself is amplifying certain frequencies.
And that's actually one place where a renter can do something. Bass traps in the corners, a heavy curtain across the window, a thick rug. None of it'll stop the transmission, but it can knock down the resonant buildup by a few decibels and, more importantly, change the character of the sound. Make it less boomy.
Less boomy matters. The emotional quality of low-frequency noise is part of what makes it torturous. It's not just loud, it's oppressive. It feels like pressure.
The term is vibroacoustic. At very low frequencies, below about 100 Hz, sound stops being something you hear and starts being something you feel. The body has receptors for vibration that overlap with hearing. So Daniel pressing his hand to the glass and feeling the percussion is also his body hearing it through his skin.
That's the sentence that should worry him. His body is hearing it through his skin.
Which is why structural mitigation is the only real fix for this particular nuisance. And structural mitigation in an apartment building is almost impossible for a renter,
Let's talk about what structural mitigation would look like if he owned the place, because he asked us to imagine that. The honest answer is that even with full ownership, you can only fix the paths you control.
The gold standard is a room within a room. You build a floating floor on resilient mounts, you decouple the walls and ceiling from the structure, you hang a new ceiling on isolation hangers. The interior room touches the building only through springs and rubber. That's how recording studios and broadcast facilities handle structure-borne noise.
And it costs what a recording studio costs.
For a single bedroom, you're looking at tens of thousands of shekels, and you lose 15 to 20 centimeters in every dimension. The floor comes up, the ceiling comes down. It's a construction project inside a construction project.
There's a beautiful irony there. The fix for construction noise is more construction.
And the room within a room has to be done perfectly. One rigid connection, one screw that bridges the isolation layer, one pipe that touches both structures, and you've created a flanking path that bypasses the whole system. That's why it fails in practice. The theory is sound. The execution is brutal.
So for Daniel's hypothetical, even with no budget limit, the answer is that you can reduce the hammering substantially, maybe another 15 to 20 decibels with a properly built isolated room, but you'll probably still hear it. The bedrock is conducting the energy into the entire building.
Unless you isolate the source, and that's the thing nobody in the apartment can do. The excavation site would need to enclose the hammer in an acoustic barrier, or use different equipment, or limit hours. Source control is always the cheapest and most effective intervention. Everything downstream is damage control.
Which brings us to the policy side, and I know you have feelings about this. Jerusalem has noise regulations. Construction is supposed to stop at certain hours, but enforcement is complaint-driven and slow.
The regulations exist. The issue is that excavation noise from rock hammering is treated the same as general construction noise, and it's not the same thing. A concrete mixer is annoying. A hydraulic hammer on bedrock is a different category of nuisance. The energy propagates through the ground for hundreds of meters. You could be two blocks away and still feel it.
Daniel's building is presumably not adjacent to the site. The fact that he can feel the percussion through the window means the ground transmission is significant. That's a geological problem as much as an acoustic one.
Jerusalem limestone is a good conductor. It's dense, it's relatively uniform, and it transmits vibration efficiently. The same property that makes it good for building makes it terrible for damping vibration.
So the city is built on a material that carries jackhammer energy like a bell.
That's not a bad image, actually. The limestone is the bell, and the hammer is the striker. The whole block rings.
Let's get to the practical toolkit, because Daniel asked for something he can use, and I want to make sure we actually deliver it. He's a renter. He can't rebuild his walls. What does he do?
Step one is the measurement protocol he's already started. Get C-weighted and A-weighted numbers, same position, window open and closed. Get a spectrum capture if possible. That tells you what you're fighting.
Step two is the vibration check. Hand on the glass, hand on the wall, hand on the floor. If the wall vibrates more than the glass, the window isn't the main path, and replacing it's a waste.
Step three is the low-cost room treatment. Heavy curtains with a mass-loaded liner, a thick rug, soft furniture. It won't stop the noise, but it'll reduce the room's own resonant amplification. In a hard-surfaced Israeli bedroom with tile floors and plaster walls, that can be worth 3 to 5 decibels of perceived reduction.
Perceived is doing work there. Decibels are logarithmic. 3 decibels is a noticeable change. 5 is clearly audible. Neither is silence.
Correct. And I want to be honest with Daniel about the ceiling here. With the window closed, he's at 40 decibels A-weighted. Room treatment might get him to 35. Bass traps might help the low end a little more. And in a multi-owner building, which is what most Jerusalem apartments are, you can't decouple your unit from the building anyway. The structure is shared. The vibration comes up through the shared walls and slab.
So the realistic renter's toolkit is damage reduction, not elimination. That's the honest answer to his question about whether this is impossible to mitigate at the structural level. As a renter, yes, essentially impossible. So the honest hierarchy is source control, which is impossible here because the excavation isn't going to stop. path interruption, which is largely impossible because the structure-borne path is through bedrock and shared building elements.
There's one more renter-level intervention worth mentioning, and it's the one people are most skeptical of. Masking, not white noise, which is too hissy. The thing I want to flag, because it's the part most coverage gets wrong, is that Daniel's windows aren't bad. 28 decibels of airborne attenuation is a solid result.
That's the part that feels like giving up. You're not removing the noise, you're adding more noise to make the original noise less salient.
It was never designed to capture the experience of a rock hammer coupling into bedrock and re-radiating through your window frame.
His wife Hannah might have a vote on that.
She absolutely does, and masking noise in a shared bedroom is a negotiation. One person's brown noise is another person's broken refrigerator.
Let's talk about the headphones more, because he raised a real problem and I don't want to just dismiss it. The issue isn't that ANC is bad. The issue is that using it as a permanent solution creates a dependency.
The technical term is habituation asymmetry. The auditory system adapts to quiet faster than it adapts back to noise. Spend 8 hours in ANC silence and the world sounds louder when you take them off. Do that for months, and some people develop a genuine intolerance for normal environmental sound.
So the recommendation isn't to never use earplugs, it's to use them as a break, not as a baseline. An hour in the afternoon when the hammering is worst. Not all day, every day.
And to protect sleep, which is the real casualty here. He mentioned waking up to jackhammering at 7 a.m. Sleep disruption from noise is cumulative. The body doesn't fully adapt to it even after years.
For sleep, the earplugs are actually justified. The risk of chronic sleep disruption outweighs the risk of earplug dependence. But he should get proper fitted plugs, not the foam ones from the pharmacy. A custom molded pair will be more comfortable and give better low frequency attenuation.
And keep them clean. Ear infections from dirty plugs are a real thing, and an ear infection on top of construction noise is a special kind of misery.
You'd know.
I've seen it. Not the construction part, the infection part. Retired pediatrician, remember?
I remember the white coat. So, we've got measurement, vibration check, room treatment, masking, earplugs for sleep. What about the legal route? He's a renter in Jerusalem, the construction has been going on for years, and it starts at 7 a.m.
The legal route is worth pursuing, but with realistic expectations. Document the noise. Keep a log. The decibel readings with timestamps are useful. File complaints with the municipality. If the construction is violating its permit conditions, there's leverage. If it's operating within permitted hours and levels, there's almost nothing to do.
And the permit is the key. Construction in Jerusalem requires a noise permit, and the permit specifies allowed hours and equipment. If the hammering is happening at 7 a.m., that's probably within the allowed window. Israeli construction typically starts at 7.
6:30 in some places. The point is, if the permit allows it, the nuisance is legal, and the legal route dead ends. What Daniel can do is check whether the permit is being followed. Wrong equipment, extended hours, work on rest days. That's where complaints have teeth.
So the practical advice includes a trip to the municipality website to pull the permit. That's the kind of unglamorous step that actually matters.
And it's the kind of thing a civic-minded person does anyway. Know what's allowed, then hold them to it.
Let's get back to the physics for a minute, because there's one piece I want to make sure we cover. Daniel said he read that low-frequency sound transmits through rock as effectively as through air. That's not quite right, and the distinction matters.
It transmits more effectively. Rock is denser and stiffer than air, so the speed of sound is much higher, and the attenuation per kilometer is much lower. Low-frequency vibration in rock can travel kilometers with very little loss. Air attenuates low frequencies less than high frequencies, but rock attenuates them even less.
So the bedrock is a better conductor than the air. That's why he can feel it through the glass. The energy is arriving through the ground, up the foundation, into the frame.
And that's why the window is almost irrelevant for this path. The window could be a perfect acoustic barrier, zero transmission, and the wall around it'd still radiate the vibration into the room.
The wall becomes a loudspeaker.
The wall is a loudspeaker. The floor is a loudspeaker. The ceiling is a loudspeaker. The whole room is being driven by the structure. That's the picture Daniel needs to hold in his head.
So when he imagines owning the place and sparing no cost, the first thing to buy isn't windows. It's a structural engineer's time to assess the transmission path.
A vibration consultant. They'll put accelerometers on the floor, the walls, the window frame, and measure what's actually moving. That tells you where to spend money. It might turn out that the window is a minor path and the real transmission is through the floor slab. Then you spend on floor isolation, not glazing.
And floor isolation in an apartment means floating a new floor on resilient pads. That's doable, but it raises the floor height, which affects doors, thresholds, built-in furniture. It's not a weekend project.
None of the structural fixes are. The honest summary for Daniel is that the full solution is a combination of source control, which he can't do, structural isolation, which he can't do as a renter, and personal mitigation, which he's already doing and finds unacceptable.
That's a grim summary.
It's a grim situation. Construction noise in a dense city is one of those problems where the individual's options are limited. The physics is unforgiving. Low-frequency impulsive noise through bedrock into a concrete building is about as hard a problem as acoustics has.
Yet people do live through it. The construction ends eventually. The excavation finishes. The building goes up. The hammering stops.
Eventually. He said it's been going on for years. That's the part that wears people down. Not the noise itself, but the open-endedness of it. No end date, no control, no way to plan around it.
The uncertainty is the real torture. He said that himself. The start-stop is hard, but the not knowing when it ends might be harder.
There's a term for that in the noise annoyance literature. It's the difference between predictable and unpredictable exposure. Predictable noise, even loud noise, is far more tolerable. People can brace for it, schedule around it. Unpredictable noise keeps the stress response running all day.
One practical step is to find out the construction schedule. If the site has a published timeline, if the municipality has the permit with a completion date, that information alone is a mitigation. Knowing it ends in November is better than not knowing if it ends at all.
That's a useful point. The psychological benefit of a known end date is real. It changes the appraisal from indefinite threat to finite inconvenience.
I want to circle back to something he said that I think is the emotional core of the prompt. He said he's not expecting to live in a library, just to have the ordinary delight of not hearing honking and hammering every day. That's a modest ask, and the fact that it feels out of reach in this city is worth sitting with.
Jerusalem is a noisy city. It's dense, it's hilly, the streets are narrow, and the construction never really stops. The baseline urban noise here is higher than a lot of people realize. So the gap between where Daniel is and where he wants to be isn't just the construction. It's the honking, the traffic, the general urban din.
Which means the acoustic windows he was heartbroken about would actually help with the honking. That's the part of his goal the glazing can address. The hammering is the part it can't.
If they do buy a place, the smart move is to do the measurement before they buy. Take a decibel meter to the viewing. Stand in the bedroom, close the window, listen. Check the C-weighted numbers. Check the vibration. That's the one thing nobody does when buying an apartment, and it's the most important acoustic decision they'll ever make.
You're saying the time to fix the noise problem is before you own the noise problem.
You can't retrofit your way out of a bad acoustic location. You can only choose a better one.
Let's pull this into the toolkit Daniel asked for. A proper list.
Measurement. Get a meter that does A and C weighting. If C is 10 or more above A, low frequencies dominate and glazing won't fix it. Capture the spectrum if you can.
Vibration check. Hand on the glass, the wall, the floor. If the structure vibrates, the problem is structure-borne and the fix is structural.
Room treatment. Heavy curtains, rug, soft surfaces, bass traps, and corners. Reduces room resonance worth a few decibels of perceived reduction.
Masking. Brown or pink noise to raise the noise floor and reduce the salience of the transients. Negotiate with the spouse.
Earplugs for sleep. Custom molded, kept clean. Use them as a break, not a permanent baseline.
Legal. Pull the permit. Check the conditions. Document violations. File complaints where there's actual leverage.
Schedule. Find out the end date if one exists. The psychological value of a known endpoint is real.
If buying, measure before you buy. The acoustic character of an apartment is a permanent feature.
The one thing I'd add is the least satisfying. Patience. Construction ends. The city moves on. The hammering will stop eventually, and when it does, the silence will feel extraordinary.
The silence will feel like a library.
He'll have earned it.
You're both right.
I did the room within a room thing 11 years ago for a neighbor who played drums. I was living in a converted warehouse in Haifa, and the guy next door had a kit set up against our shared wall. I built a floating floor and decoupled the walls. Took me 9 months of weekends. The floor was the hard part. I used rubber pads from an industrial supplier, the kind they put under heavy machinery. 50 shekels a pad, and I needed 40 of them. The walls were 2 layers of drywall on resilient channel. The ceiling I left alone, which was a mistake. Sound came through the ceiling from the floor above. The whole thing cost me about 12,000 shekels in materials, and I did the work myself, which means it looked terrible. But it worked. Cut the drum noise by about half. Still heard the kick drum. You always hear the kick drum. The problem was the door. I built this beautiful isolated wall, and then I had to put a door in it, and the door was a regular door. Sound came right through the door, so I hung a second door on the other side of the frame, like an airlock. 2 doors, a gap between them. That helped. I kept the rubber pads when I moved out. They're in a box. My claws made the installation interesting. Try holding a drywall screw with these. But I managed.
The door is the thing everyone forgets. You can build a wall that isolates 50 decibels, and a standard door gives you 20. The entire system is only as good as its weakest element.
The airlock door is actually the right solution. 2 doors with a dead air space between them is a proper sound lock. It's what studios use. It made the room feel like a submarine. You opened the first door, stepped into this little gap, closed it, opened the second door. Felt ridiculous every time. But it worked. The neighbor moved out 6 months after I finished. I never told him about the wall. He probably thought I was just unfriendly.
9 months of weekends, and the problem solved itself.
That's the thing about noise problems. Sometimes you're building a wall against something that's already leaving.
The kick drum point is important. Even a properly isolated room doesn't eliminate low-frequency impact. It reduces it. The energy at 60 Hz just laughs at a floating floor.
I could feel the kick drum through my feet, even after the floor. The pads helped with the higher stuff, the cymbals, the snare. The kick just went around everything.
That's Daniel's situation exactly. The low percussion is the part that survives every mitigation.
If I had it to do again, I'd have moved. But I was young, and I liked the warehouse.
There's a version of that advice for Daniel. The cheapest structural fix is relocation.
Which is the advice nobody wants, but it's the honest one. You can't out-engineer a bad location.
The rubber pads are still in the box. I keep thinking I'll use them again. I won't.
The open question I'm left with is whether the city will ever treat low-frequency construction noise as a distinct problem. The regulations treat all construction as one category, but the physics says a rock hammer is a different animal from a cement mixer. Until that changes, every Daniel in Jerusalem is on his own.
The deeper question is whether densification makes this worse. More buildings, more excavation, more hammering into bedrock. The city is getting denser, and the geology isn't changing.
The limestone keeps ringing.
That's the one to sit with. But for now, Daniel's toolkit is measurement, vibration check, room treatment, masking, earplugs for sleep, permit review, and patience. It's not a cure. It's a way to survive the years.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the airlock door story, which I suspect we'll be thinking about for a while.
This has been My Weird Props, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com with your own noise horror stories. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.